For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And here we are with another edition of Pollock and Thurston. John Pollock, Brandon Thurston with you on Wednesday afternoon, June the 5th. Hello, Brandon.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. We have a lot to get to on today's program. We are going to tackle the very light subject of every single legal entanglement in the history of professional wrestling. We're going to go case by case, every single lawsuit, every detail, every letter, every appeal, because we are going to be joined by a law professor, no less, in Alex B. Long, who has just put out the aptly titled book, Professional Wrestling and the Law, Legal Battles from the Ring to the Courtroom, that we saw and figured this is a guest right up our wheelhouse. So Alex will be joining us a little later on. We'll be talking about some of the cases that he covers in this book. Brandon and I have had a chance to read a portion of this book, so we will talk about that with Alex. We've also got a weekly segment on the show. We're looking for a sponsor to present Brandon Thurston's public records request findings. And boy, yes, you did some digging this past week, and you have come up with some findings the size of Texas.
Who should we reach out to? Office Max? Who's like selling office supplies or something that we could get?
Maybe Intuit Tax Turbo can sponsor the segment.
Maybe a law firm. That sounds like a high price sponsor, right?
An energy drink, perhaps.
Yes.
That doesn't have its ties to TKO in any form or fashion.
Yes.
All open ended. Although, I don't want to spoil things, but if you want to check out the free edition of WrestleNomics, if you want an example of a John Pollock cleaning his dishes and laugh out loud moment, the sponsors that Brandon has acquired for WrestleNomics definitely will catch you off guard if you go back to this past Sunday show.
Yes. I mean, yes. You get promo codes as well.
Yes.
So I've been dealing with two records requests lately. Well, today anyway. One is from Nevada. And one is related to Texas. Which one do you want us to start talking about them now, or something else?
Let's go into that a little later on. We'll do the update on the Janelle Grant case, and we'll get into that a bit with Alex as well. But since we've last spoken, that case on hold. We'll get into the details, but let's dive in. Nevada and Texas, intertwined in many ways. But let's start with the state of Nevada first, and then we will move on to Texas. And what have you uncover, Brandon, as all of these companies seeking their entanglements with various local governments?
We are still waiting on a Nevada-related records request related to WrestleMania, but this is an AEW records request. I send records requests about both companies, okay? There's no bias here. And I've been sending a records request related to Double or Nothing, and it looks like AEW got some incentives. It looks like it's getting a tax credit of in the neighborhood of $300,000, which I talked about a couple of Sundays ago on WrestleMox Radio. It looks like, AEW is spending something like $3.9 million on that 2-day taping. At least that's what they told the government in Nevada. So anyway, I got something back today, actually yesterday, and they had an agreement they gave some materials to the local government in Nevada. And one thing that they had to give to the local government in Nevada is sort of a sample of their script because they're not a sport. They're a form of filmed entertainment. They were able to qualify for this tax credit, and they had to give the local government a script to show this is, you know, that I don't know, to show that we're a real production company or something. And they gave them.
They're demanding long-term booking from these promotions.
As they should. There should be, if there's one good thing that government could do, it is put some regulations around the length of wrestling shows and long-term booking. And I got some records back, and I wondered what their emails were and what they had sent to each other. And so AEW had sent to the local government a script of the of an episode of Collision from January, something that was taped in Bossier City. Is that Louisiana?
Bossier City, Louisiana.
Yeah. And they gave me a letter back showing me that, you know, this has, I'll show it on the screen here, basically saying, here's a Thomas J. Burns, executive director, saying that pursuant to the statute and upon the request of AEW, the executive director and of the governor's Office of Economic Development has determined that the script, as required as part of the application of the Nevada Transferable Tax Credit Program, yada, yada, they have determined that this is confidential information. And they have demonstrated to the reasonable satisfaction of the government that all or a portion of that is confidential information. It consists of trade secret and is confidential economic information or other business information that should be declared proprietary and confidential, consistent with Nevada law. It's not clear what AEW has done to demonstrate that. I followed up and asked, okay, can I get, and I looked at the statute. I busted out the statute and I said, hey, look, there's four things you're supposed to attach here, and this looks like one of them. I've been back and forth with them today, and they say that they've satisfied it. There is a, it looks like AEW did put at the front of their scripts that they gave to the government, you know, a notice saying this is confidential and we don't want to share this with people. I can put that on the screen too. If we look at, let's see here.
So this would be a script for a show that happened months ago.
Yes. So this is a Collision script for the January 27th, 2024 episode from Bossier City, Louisiana. It is a Collision episode. The scripts are confidential property of All Elite Wrestling LLC and should not be made public. I would think if, you know, now they're not saying it's a trade secret, but I would think if, you know, if this is something that is a trade secret, or, and I'm just using logic here, not necessarily law. If there's something that's a trade secret and it's proprietary information, the notion is that it has to be protected so that it doesn't harm AEW's business. I can't imagine how. I'll ask the question. Can you imagine, John, any way that a collision, that me publishing a Collision script from January 27th, some 5 months ago, how that would affect AEW's business?
Well, it could take the genie out of the bottle when it comes to professional wrestling and a script being leaked. I'm just looking at this card, and maybe there is some magical trade secrets that only the top percentage of performers are known to acquire, such as the singles match involving Brian Danielson and Yuji Nagata. Maybe there were trade secrets in the construction of that match that is just not fit for the public.
We might find out who produced that match. We might find out what it was timed for. We could then cross-reference the times on Cage Match with what it was, you know, with what it was given on the script, and see who went over or under their time. I'm struggling to think of what else we might be able to extract because of the publishing of such a script.
Yeah, this is starting to be a pattern that is forming of you making these requests, and the automatic response is going to be pushback and utilizing this defense that this is a trade secret that would be detrimental to our company's business to disclose this to Brandon Thurston. And I think this is going to be something that you're going to be encountering quite a bit. So it does put, I think, these local authorities in the position to be able to ascertain what is a trade secret versus what is information for the public. And I would state that if you require a script for a show in advance, I don't know what several months later, that is going to be some trade secret that if it got out would just be the death knell for AEW.
Yeah. So along those lines, you want to go from Nevada to Texas now?
And tell us what is going on with Texas, because that is the center of the universe for a Collision this summer.
That's one of my favorite states among the 50. And we've got some news here that I've just come into my hands this afternoon. This is very new. As we know, AEW is going to Arlington. It's going to have a residency throughout parts of July and August at the Esports Stadium, I think it's called, right? Which is a government building. It's part of the Expo. It's a city owned venue and facility.
Liberal use of the term stadium.
Yes. Well, stadium, yes. It's an ambiguous term that we could debate about its actual meaning and what it actually refers to. But what I got here is some information that gives us some idea of whether or not, and what everyone's wondering about is there any kind of a site fee, or, you know, there's local governments here involved. We've been talking about that so much in relation to WWE and its goal to obtain all these site fees. We'll get to that in a moment. But what we got as part of the agreement that I obtained here as part of the Shrekers request response is, we have, you know, item number 17, radio and television broadcasts. And then we have, what do you see on the screen here for people watching or for people listening in audio only here for number 18?
For number 18 here, well, let me put my glasses on, and I would state that this is a they must have accidentally went over this entire thing and redacted it by mistake.
Because they redacted one entire paragraph, whatever paragraph 18 is, which I don't even know, can't tell you what the heading is, but there does seem to be a footnote that is referring to it where it says AEW claims this paragraph is a trade secret and therefore requests the paragraph be redacted unless and until the Texas AG's office provides a conflicting opinion. And I was provided with the letter that the city of Arlington has submitted to the Texas AG asking that this be approved as withheld. So we'll see what happens there. It's like the WWE cases. It will be sent to the AG's office. An assistant AG presumably will look at it and will actually be able to see the under-redacted version so that they can make a judgment about whether this applies to any exemption under the public information law. So don't even know what's being redacted here, but something's being redacted there. So as far as what else I've learned from this contract and from other information that we obtained here is that this is going to cost AEW $232,000 in total for its residency. So they are paying for this, but there is a term sheet that we also got here that shows that they're getting a 50% discount. So it does appear that they're getting what I would call incentives, right? They're getting a deal. And they're saving something by leaving what they call their production rig, which I think means like that big rig above the ring with all the lighting. They're going to leave that in place. So they're going to save some money by doing that. There's also language in here that I'm not qualified to decipher in terms of they're getting use of some production facilities that are part of this venue. So maybe they're sort of saving some money in that sense too. There is something in the term sheet that says that suggested that the local tourism organization might help them offset the rental costs. There's a separate agreement that's alluded to involving Arlington AEW. What does it say? The term sheet mentions the selection of Arlington for the AEW residency and the hospitality impacts that the six, actually is going to be eight, more on that later, events potentially bring to the venue and the city's entertainment district. And it also says the term sheet refers to a separate agreement between the Convention and Visitors Bureau, one party, AEW, a second party, and the Arlington Sports Commission, a third party, that will, quote, seek rental offset from the Arlington Tourism Public Improvement District, which seems like a fourth party to me. So are they getting any extra money or incentives to offset this $232,000 that they are going to spend to use the venue? Maybe. We don't know. I have sent a follow-up message through the records request system asking if this is a public record that actually exists, and I would like it, please. So they are paying something. They're not running this for free. This is certainly not a what I imagine to be a WrestleMania situation, or let's say what the classic example that we do have hard records for is a Backlash situation where WWE got $1.5 million in cash and got to use the venue for free, which they valued at $300,000. So this is not free. AEW's paying something for it. Maybe it'll eventually be free. We'll see. We'll see if we even ever know. I will try to find out though. And we did find out that this is not just going to be a six events happening in this residency. We know that there's going to be what is it? Five collisions and one Ring of Honor pay-per-view, but that yes. There's also going to be two Ring of Honor TV tapings as well, that were not part of the press release that I'm breaking right now. Go to Reddit. And the Ring of Honor tapings are going to be on July 28th and on August 16th. So those are not part of the press release, but those are going to be, events that are being taped there. Unsurprisingly, there's some allusion in these records that I've obtained here saying that Collision is going to air early on August 3rd, because SummerSlam is on that day. So look for Collision to be airing, I don't know, at 6 on TNT or something that day. And they've configured for 1,290 seats. They have a configuration that will seat that many people. And there's some prices. They've scaled the building so that, I mean, who knows with dynamic pricing what will happen, but they could, with the prices laid out right now, an average ticket price of $45, they could draw a $58,000 gate if they sold out an event. And there's some discussion here. I want to preface this and say that I've got emails here, and it reads to me, there's not much detail here, but it reads to me like this was an idea, and that I would be surprised if what I'm about to say is not news to New Japan and CMLL as well. But it does seem like there is an idea thrown around about the notion of subletting the venue to New Japan or CMLL for some of the days in this residence when there aren't AEW Ring of Honor events, which is quite a few. There are quite a few dark days here. So it looks like that's an idea that's been thrown around, but I have no reason to believe any action has been taken to make that happen.
Yeah, I would look at a lot of this that you have put together here and these figures, and it would seem like this is almost a strategy by the company to try this out. They're getting some incentives. It's not as though they're just being handed a check and this is going to be instantly profitable. They have to do some work to get people into the building. But if this is a successful enough rollout, the idea that they could do this twice a year in Arlington and as well take a template to other municipalities and state, hey, we can bring a extended residency of our Collision shows or what have you, set up 6 dates, and this is a proof of concept for us that we can guarantee you 2,000 people, well, in this case, just under 1,300, and spread that over multiple weeks where your arena may otherwise just be dark and not filling any dates. It seems like this, it's an experiment, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but it's one where at least at the end of this, you might have something that you can chop around to other parts of the country in similar size venues.
You think they'd be commissioning a economic impact study so they can say, I don't know if that would ever be announced or made public, but you see these economic impact studies that WWE announces and said, oh my God, we drew so many hundreds of millions of dollars in incremental revenue for this local area. So you would think that they would want to do that so that they could establish a track record to take to future municipalities and try to establish future residencies or even maybe someday site fees for some of their big pay-per-views or something like that to say, hey, look, this is how much extra revenue we bring to the area. And for those pay-per-views, I would say there's quite an argument that you draw traveling wrestling fans in who book hotels and spend money in other businesses that wouldn't be there otherwise.
Yeah, and I think it also shows you the commitment level here. Like, this is a, you know, we've got 1 foot semi in here. This would be quite another if that Friday, Saturday, Sunday combo that kind of is your big weekend here. If you were putting an AEW pay-per-view into one of this and putting some events around it, like, no one is traveling in for an ROH pay-per-view. Like, you are relying heavily. This is going to be this is going to be Texas-based citizens coming to this primarily in and around Arlington. So it's less travel and more so about, you know, what is the appetite for pro wrestling in this area and hitting this market. We thought 6 times, but in realistically 8 if you throw in these ROH tapings, which you would presume are going to be the smallest drawing events of this schedule that they have.
Yeah, yeah. And again, it's priced out as $14,000 per event day. And again, I'm not showing this part on the screen right now, but there is a term sheet that indicates they're giving AEW this deal at a 50% discount. Mm-hmm. So there's that.
Yeah, and the savings are big. Like, the fact is they don't have to load out every time. They just have that one check-in. You still have travel. It's not like your talent is going to be based in Arlington for a month plus. But You are making significant savings by being stationed in one area, and it's at least that way. Like, there are a number of savings built into this as opposed to being on the road every Saturday night. Right. And it does make you wonder long term how they view Collision as a touring entity, as it's been for the past year.
Right. You're covering 5 collisions here. You're still going to have to incur a lot of other costs that you would normally, but you are saving on at least, I, you know, if you're spending only $232,000 for five collisions, let's say, which is also coming with some Ring of Honor tapings and a pay-per-view. I mean, that's probably a big savings if we're just talking about those expenses compared to if you went around to NBA/NHL venues and booked five of those. That cost is probably, you know, getting into the millions, I would think.
Let's move on over the last time. Well, our show last week was on the Wednesday, and then the Thursday, all the news dropped about the updates on the Janelle Grant suit. And we're not going to go too deep into it because we did have Brandon on Rewind to SmackDown on Friday, and we kind of got the whole the up-to-date news as of last week. And there hasn't been a whole lot since then. There is a new allegation that has come out against Vince McMahon, one from Missy Hyatt from an alleged incident in March of 1987. But just to bring people up to speed on this show, the Janelle Grant case has been placed on hold. This a result of the federal investigation from the Southern District of New York into this entire case and making the request to put this on hold. And Ann Callis and her team, they are accepting of this case being put on hold. And that's sort of where we are now in terms of what is the next move from the federal investigator side and what is going to happen. And we were able to learn that the period of this pause looks to be about 6 months that it will be placed on hold. So that's the window we're looking at for some federal activity to happen.
And the impression that I get that I didn't explain on Friday night is that I think what's happening is there's evidence that this case would get it, that the civil case would get into, even though it does seem that this is going to arbitration. In any case, I think that would be the motivation for the Southern District of New York, the criminal prosecutors, presumably, putting a stay on this case so that any evidence that this case might end up bringing into discovery, that the civil case doesn't affect that evidence and that this, whatever investigation is happening here, gets to that evidence first.
Let's hear this clip from Missy Hyatt. So this happened on the Wrestling Shoot Interviews YouTube channel. She was interviewed recently, and in the discussion, they started speaking about the Janelle Grant case, and Missy Hyatt offered up her own allegation against Vince McMahon. This would have been in 1987 when she had a very brief stint with the company where they were trying her out for a new interview segment that was called Missy's Manor, that the segments do exist online, but never did make it to television. So here is a portion of that interview from the Wrestling Shoot Interviews YouTube channel.
Well, I called their lawyer and I told them my situation, what happened with me. So
what happened with you then? It's just during
Vince
the Missy's
McMahon
Manor bit.
Yeah, when I was doing Missy's Manor. Yeah, okay. I had to push Vince out of my hotel room because he was trying to stick his tongue in my mouth.
Really?
Yeah. And after I did that, next thing I know, they want me to be a federette. And I'm like, I don't want to be a federette. We were in Vegas shooting, doing the tapings. We went to like a dinner at Caesar's that they poured the wine over your shoulder. It was like a 7-course meal. This was a big, big group of people and stuff. And I remember I was wearing this leather dress and what's his name? The announcer, Mean Gene, just poured coffee in my lap. And I was like, I had a couple cocktails. So I was like, oh, okay. And he said later on that they did that to see how I'd react, to see if I'd freak out and go whatever. But they were like, oh, yeah, you handled that really well. I'm like, yeah, I had a couple cocktails. You know, I was loaded. I really didn't care. Yeah, that night he took me to my hotel, walked me to my hotel room, and he was trying to get in my hotel room. And I was like, pushing him out. Yeah. You know, I was engaged at the time. If I wasn't engaged, maybe, but he had such bad teeth. And it's like, you're a millionaire times over and you can't get your teeth fixed. He's got really bad teeth. And that just, I didn't want to stick my tongue in that.
No. I respect your decision.
And I've never had to sleep for a job. You know, I mean, yes, I've done a lot of wild things with some wrestlers and stuff like that. But I never did it for a job. And I don't think I ever had to, because I think my talent speaks for itself. So I never had to sleep anywhere to get a job.
All right. So that is the allegation made by Missy Hyatt regarding Vince McMahon. Now, I included all of that because yes, we're focusing on, first of all, the head of this company, which I would say by this point in time, there's probably zero benefit of the doubt that anyone is giving towards Vince McMahon when they hear these stories, that these are all beyond plausible stories. But I included all of that just to paint the picture as well, that not only do you have the head of this company with a talent that is still on this kind of tryout period, she's also stating she was drunk as well on top of that, which just, you know, adds another layer to all of this. But also of significance here was that when she heard about the Janelle Grant case, she reached out to Grant's legal representation, presumably Ann Callis, and stated she would be. She also spoke on the Rene Dupree podcast, stating that she would be willing to be a witness if they go that route to establish a pattern of behavior. And Brandon and I have reached out to Janelle Grant's team. They did not respond on the record to anything regarding their conversation or if they have been in touch with Missy Hyatt. But that was, you know, her outline here. And as Janelle Grant told us in their interview, like, they have spoken to lots of people. So I think you could presume that Missy Hyatt among them.
And this is the first anyone publicly is ever hearing about this story, right?
I went to look back in her book from 2001, yes. And you know, throughout the years,
asked Vix too. He said this was the first that he had heard of the story. So if this is the first he's hearing of the story, it's got to be.
Then it's never been told before. But yeah, I mean, in the book, you know, she tells the story of the dinner, and she even mentions before the dinner going by Vince McMahon's suite. But she says nothing negative about Vince McMahon. She actually praises Vince McMahon pretty heavily in the book. But I think that's also important to note for people. That book came out in 2001, and it does tell you the dynamic of anyone that has any aspirations of working in this industry, especially 2001, when the landscape was pretty dire. You're not going to be going forward with an allegation against Vince McMahon if you have any desire to work in this industry again. But yes, this is the first that she has ever noted this aspect of it, but other details of that night she has shared before, so that part did line up. And there were three different tapings between March and April of 87 that she did tapings of these Missy's Manor segments before the offer was made to be a Federette, and she turned it down and went to work with Jim Crockett.
Yeah, and to put it in time, this would be coming some months after allegedly the Rita Chatterton incident in the limousine, where allegedly Vince raped her in a limousine in New York in 1986. And to lay out the fact that in her book, none of this is mentioned, and Vince, you know, she praises Vince. You can think of reasons why in 2001 you'd be very careful to protect the image of Vince and your relationship with the company and Vince, as opposed to today, where he has at least a lot less power. And I don't know that he's ever going to have any power in wrestling again. That you may feel more free to say, you know, what your experience was.
All right. We're going to stay on that same theme, and we are going to dive into a number of different historical legal cases in professional wrestling, which has been they have been tied together for so long. The law and professional wrestling. And finally, someone has put it all together in one fine book, Professional Wrestling and the Law, Legal Battles from the Ring to the Courtroom. And joining us is the author, law professor himself, Alex Long, with us. Alex, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, I started reading your book, and just the concept of this book, I just thought, man, I've been waiting for a book like this to come along. It just seemed like this was a natural, given so many interesting lawsuits. And I think just people's curiosity of seeing more about how the sausage is made within professional wrestling. And this is kind of the avenue where you get to see that. Tell me a little bit about what went into your thinking to finally sit down and put some of these cases together through your own kind of legal history and analysis that went into it.
Yeah, you were saying it was waiting for somebody to write that book. And I've been waiting for somebody to write that book, too. So nobody was doing it. So I figured I'd go ahead and just be the one who did it. Lifelong professional wrestling fan. And as I sort of explained in the introduction, I think the idea came to me when I was teaching a class. We were doing Invasion of Privacy in one of my first year torts classes. And this is back when Hulk Hogan was suing Gawker for having published that sex tape on Gawker's website. And a couple students just sort of asked me about the case and asked me if we were going to talk about that case in class. I'm like, well, no. But, you know, the idea sort of popped in my head a little bit. Somebody should write about that case. Somebody who actually knows a little bit about wrestling might want to go delve into that at some point. And so, yeah, that was sort of the genesis for the project. It was just, you know, my interest in both the law and professional wrestling. And there are so many cases that when you look into the history a little bit, there's just a lot of interesting topics. And so I figured I'd just be the guy to take a crack at it.
It's an interesting part that we see, especially throughout the ongoing case involving Janelle Grant, is that you see a lot of, you know, wide ranges of outlets that are covering this. And I think it really does show you the people that follow the wrestling industry, because it's a very unique one. And that comes through in your book as well. Like, you're reading this and you understand it's coming from the perspective of someone that understands this industry and its history, as opposed to just being dropped in and treating this like another story. And we've seen that on the Grant side of things, where like, this is a very complex figure in Vince McMahon to break down and explain to people. And this industry, like, you kind of have to have that knowledge base coming into this.
Yeah. It's difficult for me to keep tabs on how much is going on in the professional wrestling world right now. I mean, there's so many different outlets covering everything. But I agree that I think it's useful to have some sort of perspective and understanding about how the business used to be, how it is today. It's obviously changed so dramatically from back in the days when they were wrestling in high school gyms and kind of a lawless endeavor by and large. And nowadays you've got the WWE, which has just turned into this giant corporate behemoth, right? And so it's now run like most corporations, in the laws that people, you know, back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, they just kind of disregarded at the time when wrestling was this little back alley niche entertainment form. You know, nowadays it's not that anymore, right? I mean, you got a board of directors with WWE, you've got all the sort of standard legal mechanisms in place, and they're bound by legal concepts in a way that historically they just hadn't been. And so it's an interesting time, I think, with the Janelle Grant lawsuit right now, reflecting the way the WWE has advanced just in the last, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, I want to ask you about, you know, some of these cases that you go through. You go through all these cases that have all different forms of law that pertain to them. And I think it's just reading the introduction, the preface yesterday and today, I thought it was, I feel like you were speaking to me as like you're looking through, you're using wrestling as a window to look through all of these different avenues of the law. But I want to ask you about the Grant case, in that this 6-month stay that is now on the case, does that tell us anything about what to this point is just referred to by Ann Callis, Grant's lawyer, as a non-public investigation? Doesn't take, it probably doesn't take a lawyer to think that this is probably related to a criminal investigation, but does it tell you anything that you can say without speculating too far?
Yeah. So I guess I'll put the disclaimer at the beginning. You know, who knows, right? Who knows exactly what's going on? But yeah, my first response was, DOJ's thinking at least about bringing criminal charges, and is something has happened recently that makes DOJ want to have this stay issued so that they can proceed. I mean, you know, whether it is they're on the verge of indicting Vince and John Laurinaitis, whether they found some witness that hasn't been referenced before who's willing to come talk to them, you know, maybe they're trying to flip John Laurinaitis. Who knows? I mean, there are a bunch of different things that are going on, potentially going that, on,
that,
right?
Does that 6-month period tell you anything in particular?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? I mean, 6 months, it sounds to me that what they're really going to try to do in those 6 months is try to investigate everything they can thoroughly. So that's my guess, is they're trying to carve out this 6-month period to do some pretty in-depth investigation. But beyond that, I'm really not sure. But it sounds like it has moved to a more serious phase in the investigation, I guess I would say.
Yeah. And does it sound right? I'm assuming that they're putting a stop of a hold on this civil case for now, because they're probably worried that they would be getting to evidence that they want for their presumably criminal case.
Yeah. So it does happen from time to time that you've got parallel civil proceedings, like the lawsuit and then criminal proceedings, and they're going on at the same time. But as you might imagine, they kind of intersect with each other and can kind of interfere with each's evolution and development a little bit. So, what a lot of times will happen is that the potential criminal defendant, if there have actually been criminal charges filed, the criminal defendant might be the one who would ask for a stay so that the defendant isn't fighting basically a battle on two different fronts, right? The civil lawsuit and then the DOJ prosecution. Or it's possible, I mean, possibly that the plaintiff in the civil lawsuit might want to have a stay issued. But yeah, what I think from Vince's standpoint and John Laurinaitis' standpoint, WWE in general, during the civil lawsuit, they might be asked questions that might prompt them to want to go assert their Fifth Amendment privilege, right? They don't want to speak on vice of counsel because it might incriminate them. But by doing that, when you invoke your Fifth Amendment rights in a civil lawsuit, it's possible that when the case gets to trial, that your refusal to answer a question, that your refusal to, or that your assertion of the Fifth Amendment rights, that can be held against you in a civil case, that the judge can instruct the jury that they can assume that what you would have testified actually would have been harmful. It'll create what they call an adverse inference, that the jury is allowed to infer that there's bad stuff that the defendant didn't want to talk about. So there's a real risk to the criminal defendant in asserting the Fifth Amendment in a civil proceeding, even though it might help him in the criminal proceeding, it might hurt him in the civil proceeding as well. So yeah, I think the idea of the stay is just to try to keep the evidence separate, keep things from getting too meshed up and interfering with both matters at this point.
Yeah. And one, there seem to be at least two kinds of possible charges that they're looking into, in that there's obviously all these allegations of sexual misconduct, but there's also the element of the NDAs and the financial aspect that goes with that, in that there were millions of dollars that were spent on NDAs that WWE itself has determined should have been company expenses. I guess, is it plausible that this is actually just about that financial aspect and not about the sexual assault aspect, which I want to mention has been reported by the Wall Street Journal that is what they're looking into. But is it possible that this could just be financial business?
Sure. That would make a lot of sense as well, right? I mean, that what they're looking into is basically white collar fraud pertaining to the payments themselves. And so, yeah, maybe that's what it is. In which case, yeah, that evidence would overlap with Janelle Grant's lawsuit, but not to the same extent as if the DOJ proceeding is actually about sexual assault and sex trafficking. That would make those two cases run, you know, directly parallel to each other. So, yeah, it's entirely possible that it's what you suggested.
And in the event that we were to get a criminal indictment towards Vince McMahon or any of the other defendants, what becomes of the civil suit at that point? Would it be just on hold temporarily, or could both go forward? How is something like that determined if we are talking about actual federal charges?
Yeah. Yeah. So they both could go forward at the same time. In which case, again, you know, the defendants in this case would be fighting a war on two different fronts, which is difficult. What I think would be most likely to happen is that the defendants would probably request a stay if the Department of Justice actually brings criminal charges against them. They request a stay in the civil proceedings. Criminal matters are going to take precedent just because of the interest involved. But yeah, they could potentially be going at the same time. My guess is more likely that the defendants will, again, assuming that there is some sort of criminal indictment, that the defendants would request a stay and to postpone the civil proceedings for a while until the criminal proceedings play out. What's useful for the plaintiffs is that once the criminal, if there are criminal proceedings and if there's any evidence that comes out, that's really helpful for the plaintiffs, right? They can use the criminal process to help them discover the relevant facts. And they can also pin the defendants down on things that they've said during the criminal proceeding, right? If Vince or somebody testifies at trial that he said X, Y, Z, and then they bring out the civil proceeding and Vince doesn't say exactly the same thing, he says something a little bit off, they can use that to go impeach his credibility. So there's definitely an advantage for the plaintiffs in the civil proceeding to kind of let the criminal proceeding play out and then cherry pick what comes out of that criminal proceeding for their own benefit.
I guess something that I think some of our audience is thinking about, I think it gets into something more far-fetched, but in the event that Vince is convicted and has to, you know, face jail time or something like that, and let's imagine that he has a friend who's the president at the time, is it plausible to think that he could be pardoned in that case?
I hadn't thought about that. I guess when you're talking about Vince McMahon and Donald Trump, anything is possible, right? So I certainly wouldn't rule that out. I'd forgotten the Trump McMahon connection, but yeah, sure.
Well, that could reopen the SmackDown Your Vote campaign, I guess. Supporters out there.
Wrestling fans, pay attention. Yeah, your vote matters.
When it came to kind of looking at like a wide brush of various historical legal cases, I mean, you really go deep in some of these, like reading right at the beginning, the Ron Fuller suit, which was just like astounding to read about this. Tell us a little bit about how you kind of broke down like what cases to focus on and sort of how you approached a lot of these, because sometimes you can get really lost in some of these lawsuits. Yeah. And you're explaining it to people that don't know a whole lot of like the legal breakdowns, which it's a skill in of itself to kind of break these down just in regular speak to people.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to do. So I imagine some people who buy the book are professor. Actually, I know a few law professors who are wrestling fans, but lawyers who are wrestling fans, and there are actually a good number of them. But mostly non-lawyers, right? Non-lawyers who are wrestling fans. I tried to pick cases that were either infamous or otherwise relatable. There's a little section in there about the past sexual discrimination, sexual harassment cases that the WWF, WWE had faced. But my goal was to try to explain concepts, legal concepts, in a way that non-lawyers could relate to and to use a medium, professional wrestling, in a way to do it. So like the Ron Fuller case, and for folks who don't know, back in the 70s, there was a group of wrestlers in Ron Fuller's territory right here in Knoxville, Tennessee, that basically tried to go steal his promotion out from under him. And it resulted in a bunch of litigation in town. That case was just so crazy that I just thought it was fun to talk about, where there are others that I think are more serious. You know, for example, the WWE concussion lawsuit years ago, that's a really complicated one. And that requires, that's not as, not as sexy as like the Ron Fuller case, where people are trying to steal a promotion out from somebody. But the legal issues in the concussion case, for example, I think were really serious. And the stuff like sexual harassment, a lot of people have a vague understanding of what sexual harassment is. But I tried to use those cases back from the 80s and the 90s to try to illustrate really what the law is about and how it played out in those situations.
Yeah, I think if people read this book, they'll be struck, as I was, that you have a really strong handle of wrestling history. And as John said, it's not somebody sort of dropping in and, you know, writing a fun book because it's about pro wrestling. You really know the culture of this industry, which I appreciate. And there's a lot of stories in there in the beginning about, I guess there's, you know, up until around the 80s or the 90s, there's a lot of protecting kayfabe and not being open even in court about the notion that wrestling matches are predetermined. And some of that is touched on in the Fuller and Garvin case, but there's other cases of wrestlers, you know, denying that wrestling is predetermined under the penalty of perjury. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the more interesting things to me, was to go dive back into history a little bit and see these wrestlers and promoters say with a straight face, under oath, under penalty of perjury, no, none of these outcomes are predetermined. The ref never told me to do anything. They just told me to go out and have a good match. And then obviously when word breaks in the late 80s that Vince McMahon comes forward and admits that these matches are predetermined, eventually that stops being a consideration in these cases. And now all of a sudden we just treat these cases the way we would any other sort of business or profession, right? But yeah, prior to that time, the lengths to which wrestlers and promoters would go to commit perjury to go protect the business was pretty remarkable, I think.
You know, the argument that seems to always resurface every couple of, you know, news cycles is always the independent contractor debate, and just coming from your experience as well. And we can even make this specific to WWE, because I think you can find differences between various companies and the constraints that they have on their performers. But when you are looking at the WWE performers, like, you have a class of talent now that are probably, they're making more money than any time in the history of this company. But you still look in terms of if Brandon and I want to just speak to one of these people, like, you have to go through these channels just for them to be allowed to do a third party interview. And that's a very small example of just freedoms that they have. But you know, these are performers that are, they're on the clock. They are scheduled to be at a place on this date at this time. They have to go by codes of conduct. They have, they're subjected to drug testing. And I mean, they seem just from the outside looking in, like these would check off a lot of boxes of employees versus independent contractors.
Yeah. I agree. You know, a lot of times I'll try to play it straight and not pick one side or the other, or tell you how I think the case maybe should have come out. But in this particular example with the independent contractor question, yeah, to me, everything I've seen up to the present day leads me to conclude that modern WWE performers are employees. The key question usually is the control to which the employer exercises over how the employees go about doing their job and then other restrictions that they place on them. And yeah, WWE, from everything I understand at least, has got extensive control. Not just in terms of what takes place inside the ring itself, not what takes, just what takes on microphones. But like you're describing, right? They're limiting their ability to go, earn money on the side. They're limiting their ability to go do interviews with the media. That's the control that an employer exercises over an employee. And once you break down that structure, I mean, I feel confident there'll be a decision out there that just says, yeah, these performers are employees. And then once you do that, that opens up a whole new can of worms, a whole bunch of new legal theories that currently aren't available to independent contractors, because there are a lot of laws that just don't protect independent contractors. They only protect employees. So I think one day that house of cards is going to come down. Honestly, I'm kind of surprised it hasn't happened before now. And again, the WWE, like you sort of point out, right? There's a difference between WWE and AEW in terms of the control that they exercise. But if you're talking about the WWE, yeah, I think that's a house of cards that'll fall during my lifetime, I think.
Do you have any ideas for like what the easiest path to challenging, to a successful challenge of an independent contractor would be? Because we've even seen in the UFC case where I think people would argue that those are employees as well, and that the antitrust case that went on for 10 years and was just settled, and they're still going to be classified as independent contractors.
Yeah. What the easiest route is to accomplishing that, I mean, it's going to take somebody who's willing to run the gauntlet of possibly being retaliated against in the industry, right? I mean, if you go sue WWE and claim that they've withheld where they didn't withhold taxes that they should have withheld, they weren't paying whatever rate, whatever benefit it was to which you say you were entitled and you didn't get. By doing that, by filing that lawsuit, you're obviously making management angry. And so one of the biggest deterrents to any employer, independent contractor filing a lawsuit is just that fear of retaliation. So what would it take? I mean, I think it's going to take something like a wrestler on the back end of his or her career who's willing to go run that risk, like a Chris Jericho kind of guy. But you know, somebody who's actually willing to take that risk without really the fear of retaliation at this point.
Yeah, I think it's just following it so much. I look at just professional wrestlers that mean so many. It's always that having one more run in them, and just that idea of any kind of mass organization just seems so out of grasp for many of them, that you truly need something to spearhead it in such a way. And if you're a WWE talent, you're making great money, and why am I going to rock the boat and look at the potential of like a 10-year legal fight with WWE? I mean, there's a lot of reasons to just, you know, accept the terms as they are, but I do feel there will be a time that they look back in these astronomical television deals that talent has 0% of to claim for it. That, you know, if this were the NBA, like these players, they enjoy the successes of all these television rights escalating to astronomical levels.
Yeah, and I would like in a case of a Chris Jericho, I think he's been open about that. He's a dual class. He's an employee, right, but he's also a contractor. But I would think would you make yourself toxic to AEW as well if you were starting to challenge that? Because I've done sort of the mock multi-factor test, and I think the argument is easier to make against WWE, but I think there's a strong argument against AEW too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what's interesting, and I touch on it just briefly in the book, right, is that during that brief period where WWE was the only game in town, right, where they'd run WCW out of business, there was really nobody, you didn't really have any other option if you wanted to make a living full-time being a professional wrestler. WWE is the only place you could go. now with AEW as a viable alternative, where you can, maybe you're not going to make as much as you would at WWE, but you can still bang out a living in AEW. That takes some of the pressure off. Maybe perhaps your willingness to go challenge the status quo a little bit. And particularly since, you know, WWE is now more of just a standard corporation than Vince McMahon's private plaything, right? I mean, back in the day, if you got on the wrong side of Vince, boom, your career was pretty much over at that point, at least in WWE. With WWE being run more like a traditional business at this point, I don't think they can afford to be as callous and flippant as like a sole proprietor who runs the business can be. I mean, they've got bureaucracy, they've got boxes that they've got to check, legal obligations they have to satisfy. So the threat of retaliation might be less today than it was in years past. One, because Vince is no longer a player in the field, and you've got AEW as a possible alternative source of income for you.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you go through specifically the WWE's legal history, and I'm sure many of those cases are represented in the book, give me some insight into your thought on the value of a Jerry McDivitt in the history of this company, because when you sort of like catalog like what controversies and legal threats this company has gone through, it's actually remarkable they are where they are today.
Oh, yeah. I didn't get into the whole steroid trial because that's a book in and of itself.
That could be its own book. Like, yeah.
Right? Yeah. But when you look at how Jerry McDivitt was able to navigate that company away from all of the potential legal liability that it has faced over the decades, it's pretty remarkable. Yeah, he is the MVP for sure of that organization when it comes to the legal jeopardy that they faced over time. He's done up until this point, has done just an absolutely remarkable job keeping that company out of much bigger trouble than it could have faced.
We will wrap up here. One more question I had for you, and it's one that I just always cannot quite wrap my head around, but maybe you can give me sort of the argument maybe in favor of it, is that this is a WWE example. It's an AEW one too. Like, so many times we'll hear talents and they'll talk about their contract status and they'll be like, well, I think it's up, you know, in this ballpark. And we have It's just been a generation of wrestlers that, well, if you get hurt for 6 months, we can just tack on 6 months to your contract. And part of me is just, I would love to see one person challenge this just to see what the legal argument would be for this. I mean, am I kind of just like overlooking like that this is, a common practice, or is this something that could be challenged? Because it just feels like a natural hazard of the job is injury, and that you owe time at the end of your contract if you get hurt performing your task.
Yeah, I mean, that's another area in which the whole employee independent contractor thing really starts to matter, because if you're injured on the job as an employee, there's this whole set of laws that protects you. Whereas if you're an independent contractor, you're kind of more at the mercy, and it makes it easier for an organization to do what it is you're suggesting, right? So go, let's just go tack on this extra time here at the month, rather than paying you workers' compensation benefits or giving you time off under the Family Medical Leave Act. We're just going to stick it to you at the back end of this. So, it's another example of where that whole independent contractor employee status thing really has got some teeth and really matters, I think.
The book is Professional Wrestling and the Law, Legal Battles from the Ring to the Courtroom by Alex Long. It's available on Amazon. I definitely recommend people going into check out the rest of this. I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the book. And you might have a series on your hands, Alex. You could get the steroid trial follow-up, independent contractors. I mean, I don't think there is a limit when it comes to the tunnel of legal entanglements within the professional wrestling industry.
Already thinking about it. Thank you guys for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Alex. All the best with the book. Thank you.
Take care.
All right, everyone. Alex Long joining us, and you've had a chance to read a bit more of the book than I have, but some of the other cases, including the defamation suit that Hulk Hogan filed against WCW after the Bash at the Beach shoot work promo from 2000, and other cases as well. But the Ron Fuller one was the one I went through this morning, and it's just amazing. It's
the first one in the book. Yeah.
Ron Garvin, boats, title belts. Yeah, if you remember a number of years ago, this video surfaced of Ron Garvin, Bob Roop. It was several of the performers that they were going to.
I've not seen this video, but I
remember this being a big deal when it was just all of a sudden one day popped up on YouTube, of them pretty much just going on their TV to announce that.
And this is like 1979, right?
79, 80, yeah, that period of they were just going to like expose the business as this tactic against Ron Fuller as well. So that's covered. As Brandon mentioned, like Alex really knows his stuff when it comes to the history, and that, I mean, for any fan that is reading this, like you can sniff through the people that are just kind of moonlighting on professional wrestling and covering it and learning from scratch versus those that have lived it, absorbed it, and understand the culture, because there is a big difference that we see covering a lot of these different stories, because it's a unique animal to kind of untangle and figure out from a legal perspective, that here are these lifelong, you know, especially from a prior generation, con men that are now placed into a legal setting where it's kind of the antithesis of that.
And it's really interesting in this, it's NWA v. Garvin, but it's really Ron Fuller, right? And it's this case, weird case over a boat where like they were going to have a tournament and Ron Fuller was going to win the tournament. But it was basically a way for Ron Garvin to take out a loan from the promotion for this boat that he wanted. But in the course of the case, you know, which is my knowledge of this is from reading the book earlier today. In the course of this case, there's this argument about what's called unclean hands, in that the court shouldn't be expected to enforce the law in favor of somebody who has unclean hands, which means in this case is, you know, deceptive and is such a con man as a pro wrestler in 1980 was perceived to be. You know, you're deceiving the public and putting on these phony wrestling matches. That sort of precludes or preempts your, you know, appeal to the court that the law is being violated. Which has sort of reminded me of the roots of the industry, which we get further away from every day. But it's with the roots of this industry as being, you know, sort of founded in deception and in avoiding the full truth and in sort of condescending to the audience and sort of assuming that they're not entitled to know more. And so you can see why, finally, I mean, to make this about ourselves here, why such an industry would be adverse to people reporting facts. You know, that the truth is kind of inherently, you know, deeply baked into the DNA of this industry, that, you know, the truth is kind of a threat.
I mean, it's kind of what you're experiencing, it seems, on a weekly basis right now. So definitely, yeah, we'll chat more about the book as Brandon and I go through it. I'm sure there'll be some interesting analysis of various cases here. Before we wrap up, let's talk a bit about TNA Wrestling, which is I believe Thursday they are presenting their 20th anniversary edition of Impact, since they went on to Fox Sportsnet. That is coming up on Thursday. Well, to mark the occasion, there were multiple departures from TNA over the past week or so, including creative director David Sahadi, VP of marketing Lou DeAngeli, the former sign guy Dudley, who has transitioned to become a marketing exec in WWE, Cirque du Soleil, and then most recently TNA. Also, and a hat tip here to Lavi Margolin on the Business of the Business podcast, who noted that on the Anthem website, Richard Schaefer, who was announced as the president of Anthem Sports Group in March of 2023, no longer represented on the Anthem executive, among the Anthem executives on their website. So, to be determined what exactly his status is with the company, but, you know, this affecting their live events department, affecting, you know, marketing. These are key positions that they are, getting rid of the heads of, and it remains to be seen. Are there going to be people hired in these spots, or is this just work that is going to be tacked on to existing members of the company? And, you know, their long-term plans with TNA, that naturally is going to be a question. As long as Anthem sees this as viable programming, they're going to continue to support it and have so for almost 8 years. But it also becomes a question of, their own viability of TNA and comes just over the past week, where you've had this integration with NXT that has provided TNA with some extra added buzz through Jordan Grace appearing on their program and at the Battleground show this Sunday.
Yes, which has led some people to wonder, is WWE going to buy TNA? They gonna acquire it? And who knows? I mean, I've been told that
You go first, and then we can.
I've been told that this relationship between WWE and TNA, which you've really seen since, I would say, Royal Rumble earlier this year when Jordan Grace appeared in the Royal Rumble. But I've been told that this is sort of encouraged by the idea that TKO is coming out of a UFC antitrust lawsuit. WWE just settled an MLW antitrust lawsuit, that if you have a relationship with another wrestling player, it helps you assuage an argument that, you know, you're violating antitrust. So that may be what's playing into WWE's decision to work more with TNA.
And that would make a lot of sense. I think we could expect that Marigold in Japan might have, you know, similar opportunities to get dates on WWE talent. This is not the kind of, you know, enclosed world that, you know, Vince McMahon provided for years with WWE. But my question to you would be, if that were a theory, why would WWE want to buy TNA as opposed to letting talent contracts expire and signing? This is not the era where a video, like, what is the value of a TNA video library to WWE in this current environment where I like, much like AEW getting ROH's tape library, like, where is that value for WWE to buy another company?
Yeah. And I don't want to compare TNA to these two companies, but we've seen the WXW library rights that W apparently had. Those have expired or are going to expire very soon. Progress expired a long time ago. I understand the Evolve stuff is still on because I think W bought that outright, but it's been a long time. I mean, with that WWN exception, it's been a long time since W acquired a library, right? And I think that the contributing value that you're getting, and TNA would be the biggest one out there, I guess, other than like AEW or New Japan or something. The value that you're adding is probably pretty minimal at this point, when the bulk of what you really are selling from a media standpoint is your live content. It's not like you're going to sell DVDs at this point. You're just going to add hours onto your library. I would almost argue that it would have more value to AEW, in that, you know, AEW doesn't have much of a library compared to WWE, but really ultimately, I don't know how much value this really adds. You know, I've been kind of a pessimist on the notion that the Ring of Honor deal adds that much value to AEW, either from a library standpoint or a weekly content standpoint. But yeah, why would you buy it? To acquire some wrestlers? I don't know. It's sort of like, why would you buy Paramount? You know, which is something that's happening in the larger media world right now. It's, I don't know if TNA is a declining asset, but Paramount is certainly a declining asset. And it's not something that's, you know, it's not like there's great reason to be hugely optimistic about the future of those companies. And just the longer you let it go, and let's imagine if TNA is not profitable, which I kind of guess that it's not, or it's at least being subsidized by a larger parent company, the longer you let it go on, you kind of have your pick of who the talent are, that who you want from there. So what you're getting some intellectual property and some video, which I don't know has a great deal of value, certainly on the WWE scale.
One thing to note, and I'm impressed, we've gone an hour and we did not talk about AEW's television rights once on this show. It's kind of just at it seems like in the sports world, people are exhausted about the NBA TV talks, and in pro wrestling, it's the AEW talks have probably reached everyone's limit. But a bit of an update regarding the NBA rights and how it might pertain to Peacock is that the Wall Street Journal is reporting that once this is completed, the expected deal between the NBA and NBC, they would have the ability to air about 100 games per season for the NBA. And the Wall Street Journal is reporting that about half of that inventory would be exclusive to Peacock, and adding that they would have weekly games on NBC on Tuesday and Sunday, and then the Peacock exclusive games. It's unknown what games would be earmarked for the USA network as well, that you would think would probably be cut into some kind of package if NBC in fact does get their portion of the NBA rights. But it does make for an interesting play with Peacock and making, you know, 50 exclusive games onto the streaming platform, which you would think, like, that will be a difference maker for some when it comes to subscribing to Peacock.
Yeah. And then Peacock has been continuing to grow in terms of subscribers every quarter sequentially. They've been up. I think they're at about 31 million at the last report from Comcast. So that puts them, they're above ESPN Plus. You know, they're starting to get into the territory where, I mean, they're still about half of what Netflix is. But they're starting to get into some higher territory. And you could see that meshing well with NBA's younger viewing audience. And it looks like Amazon Prime is going to end up with some of this as well. So you're going to have more sports shifting to streaming.
Last topic, and I didn't list this one for you, Brandon. I'm just going to ask you to pick your brain here. When it comes to Tuesday night, Vice released their Who Killed WCW series. In about 2 weeks' time, on June 16th, A&E is going to be doing a one-hour episode dedicated to ECW. And my question to you is, 23-plus years removed from the end of WCW and ECW in their prior form, so to speak, why is there still such an appetite for that era of professional wrestling? And do you feel that, like, that nostalgia, has it grown over the last number of years since WWE has heated up? Do you think it's declined somewhat? Because I feel like there was a generation of fans that were watching this WWE product, reflecting on the days of 98 through 2001 through rose-colored glasses. And now you do have a product that I think is satisfying a lot more of its fan base. But just some of your thoughts on just why that period of wrestling is so romanticized.
I don't know. I guess my theory is that there's sort of this nostalgia sweet spot, which is after the VCR, but before streaming video and the peak of wrestling, I would say outright, right? And including ECW and WCW is right in the middle of that, right? Right in the late '90s and a little bit of the early 2000s, I guess. And it's not where you're overwhelmed yet with video like you would be beginning in the 2010s. But you do have access to lots of media because the VCR is out there and cable TV is out there. And I think it creates a little bit of a perfect storm, combined with the popularity of wrestling during that time. That would be the argument that I would put forward.
Well, this series, it's going to feed the wrestling podcast, beast, I would say, for many personalities.
Can't wait.
Out there that are going to get plenty of content. Did you watch the first episode? On
I did not. I thought about it, but that was last night, right? It was on. Yes. I might watch it. I'll listen to you guys talk about it at least.
Well, that's a great segue because tonight it's a doubleheader on Post Wrestling. Wayne and I will go live at 10 Eastern with Rewind to Dynamite. And then at 11, we're flipping over postwrestlingcafe.com. You can jump on and we will discuss episode one of Who Killed WCW. Brian Mann, former WWE writer, now attached with Hot Ones. You might be familiar with the series. He will join us for his thoughts on Who Killed WCW, the murder mystery.
Yes. Everybody tune in.
WrestleNomics is coming up Sunday. Patreon.com/WrestleNomics. And Brandon will have, I am sure, more responses, requests. Nevada, Texas, look out. And all states, be on the lookout in your inbox.
And you never know when we're going to get an AWTV deal announcement. If Matt Bellany is right, if the exclusive negotiating window ends in July, we could learn about that anytime. And you never know when new legal filings will be filed. I'm checking all the time.
You know, I've got the alarm bell emoji on my phone just on standby, and that'll be what I send Brandon for. I would say, like, there's two stories off the top of my head that would require the alarm bell, the AEW TV rights being one of them.
You have the alarm bell? Oh, you were going to send me an alarm bell.
An emoji. Yeah, I just send you the emoji. And that would be like the best.
I don't know if you've ever sent me an emoji before. That would be the first, I think.
No. I'm very selective on emojis. I'm not anti-emoji, but it's rare that I bust out the emoji. Okay. But AEW TV rights might require it. All right. That's going to wrap things up, everybody. Look out for this weekend. NXT Battleground in front of 700 of their closest friends at the UFC Apex.
Yes. It'll be interesting to see what that atmosphere is like.
It is. I'm curious to see how they produce a show there, how you compare it to a lifeless UFC Fight Night card in the same venue. And we will see what fan base shows up for this, whether it's a one-off or the start of something new at the UFC Apex. But that's going to wrap it up. Thank you to Alex Long for joining us. And that concludes Pollock and Thurston.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe. and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.